This podcast edition of Section D was first broadcast on the 17th of January 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on this week's show, we set sail in a one-bedroom apartment in the shape of a boat overlooking the Thames.
If you look at it completely literally, it's just a comfortable space to stay, but it's a lot more than that. It's a boat in places where boats are not supposed to be. It's a boat high up. It's a space that's both new and old.
We rifle through the favourite things of New York gallerist Murray Moss.
Which I never show anybody. There's a picture of my sister Jean. This was taken, I'm guessing, around 1964. And my sister Jean decided to become a kabuki dancer.
Okay.
And we drop in on a pretty perfect spot of prefab architecture in Ljubljana.
The clients come to us because our competition won't do what they wish. If a client comes to us and he wants, I don't know, chicken feathers on his facade, we can do it. We'll say yes and we'll do it. We'll figure out a way.
All that to come, plus a studio visit with Brent Comer in Vancouver, a catch-up with Nilla Juul Sorensen, the Danish Design Centre's new CEO, and a spot of light shopping to brighten up the dark days of January. Places to stay in London are ever more scarce, overpriced and underwhelming. But the latest addition to Alain de Botton's living architecture rental properties is anything but. Built by young architect David Cohn and artist Fiona Banner, it's a one-bedroomed apartment in the shape of a boat, marooned on the top of the South Bank Centre, overlooking the Thames. We sent our reporter, Amanda Brown, to set sail.
Christchurch Spitalfields has a pyramidal spire with an octagonal interior room, and that's how you gain the maximum amount of space within a pyramidal form. We were aware of these connections, and I suppose that's a kind of echo of the city that you can see across the river.
On the roof, it's peaceful as can be.
Architect David Cohn has been showing journalists around the boat he and artist Fiona Banner designed, which is currently perched on the top of the Queen Elizabeth Hall on the South Bank.
It's a piece of architecture in the shape of a boat. The brief of the competition that we entered a year ago now was to create a room that visitors could occupy for a night and that would invite them to reflect on their relationship to London and to the wider world during the 2012 Olympic year. There are both kind of narrative and poetic and pragmatic reasons for it being a boat. From a kind of narrative and poetic perspective, this brief, the idea that you would go up into this room and want to reflect on the nature of London, your relationship to it, made us look for narratives that you would become part of. So something that preceded you being there and something that would continue after you've gone and perhaps connect your stay to others.
The concept of the riverboat, which is too heavy to float, is inspired by Joseph Conrad's novel The Heart of Darkness, with its themes of travel and displacement.
And so we started to look for stories that were about London, but also about its connection to the wider world. And Conrad's Heart of Darkness was a kind of perfect starting point, as it is a story that's actually narrated on the banks of the Thames to a group of mariners about a journey to the Congo, to a far-flung place, but also into the kind of darker aspects of human nature.
Though that waiter had pushed the darker aspects of my human nature, I wanted to know why put the boat on the top of a famous building in London.
So my name is Alain de Botton. We're currently in central London on the Queen Elizabeth Hall overlooking the River Thames in a boat for an organisation called Living Architecture, which I head up.
You want to say anything?
No, all right, I'll. We had 500 entries, and David Cohen's and Fiona Banner's entry won. And what particularly charmed us about it was the number of layers that
is in their concept. It's, you know, if you look at it completely literally, it's just a comfortable space to stay, but it's a lot more than that. It's a boat in places where boats are not supposed to be. It's a boat high up. It's a space that's both new and old. It's a space that's rich with symbolism.
Please don't you rock my boat, 'cause I don't want my boat.
The Boat is to play host to musicians and artists who will play and create within its confines, beaming the results live online. Artist Fiona Banner.
I trained as a painter and spend most of my time working, writing and working with text. You know, I suppose the whole aspect of this project, which is really about stories within stories, right back to the Heart of Darkness, which is itself a story within a story, told on the banks of the River Thames just here, was really at the heart of this project. So, you know, we've created now the vessel for other people's stories. And that's a theme that's very much at the heart of my work, is how stories are told and myths are created, and how in turn those myths often inform history and our sense of reality.
Boat on a building, you don't think London necessarily, you might think Brighton or Portsmouth or Southampton. So how is this so apt for the middle of London?
Well, of course, the River Thames is crucial to London, yet it's so often forgotten. And Londoners tend to look at the Thames and occasionally get surprised by its appearance and by the fact that it's almost a challenge to the daily life that we have in this city, which is so focused on human beings and our concerns and our meetings and our obsessions. And suddenly you see the water, and the water speaks of a different rhythm of time, speaks of nature, and it immediately induces a kind of sense of perspective. And to look at that from a boat, and you really have a wonderful perspective over the river, and yet you're not on the river, and yet you're on a boat. So it fries your mind in a good way, productive way.
David Conn sees the construction as pivotal.
The narrative side of it, that it would be a boat about a journey, about journeys in literature, also fitted with the practical issues that we really ought to build it off-site, and it should be delivered to site. So we wanted there to be a narrative about it, not just as though one understands it in its place, but one understands that there's a backstory to how it got there. And so we spent time trying to find craftspeople who would make an extraordinary craft. And I have to say that Millimeter, based in Brighton, have done an extraordinary job, incredibly skilled. And I think the quality of the construction is what I think supports these multiple interpretations. If it had been built like a stage set, I think the whole thing would have been flimsy, both at a literal and a kind of metaphorical level.
The Boat's era is impossible to pin down. Though it contains an uber-trendy wet room shower, to get to the top of the boat, visitors must climb through two portholes via ladder.
You're elementally incredibly exposed, but socially it's a very intimate space. And we wanted to draw on that vulnerability and sense of exposure and the precariousness, the vertiginous feeling of being up there on the roof. And yet, at the same time, we wanted to sort of emphasise this idea of being held in this little interior, this heart of a space up there.
So, when you're next walking along the embankment, wondering if you really have finally lost your marbles because you can see a boat on the roof of the South Bank Centre, it's okay. It's just there to engender a sense of contemporary and historical reflection on the nature of displacement and London's past, present and future. Simple.
That was Amanda Brown in London, reporting from Alan de Botton's Room for London boat on the South Bank Centre. Murray Moss is one of the design industry's best-loved characters. Together with his partner, Franklin Getchell, they run Moss Gallery on Green Street in New York, presenting a range of furniture, products and artwork by designers old and new. Moss is far more than a gallerist, though. He's also an expert storyteller, as our New York editor, Aisha Spears, found out when she dropped by his Manhattan apartment.
I like a lot of things, but I made a list of some of the things. Well, the Candida Hofer, the photo of the room, the St. Emmeron in Regensburg, Bavaria, Schloss, you know, that was begun as a monastery and converted to in 1731, that's the photograph of the ballroom, so it's high Baroque, moving into Rococo, more Rococo looking. And then it became an official residential palace and still is occupied by the Turnataxi family in 1812. And what I like about Candida's work in the big scale is I treat them like movie sets, because, you know, like scenery that we were talking about, because there's no people in it. So you get to be there in the room alone. What I like about this particular image, which I think is an exceptional one, is you have this ballroom from 1731, very ornate. It's one of my favorite things, is that period, of course, and with a projector in it. So when I walk in the front door, I go, and I flip on the light, I really feel I'm flipping on the film of my small apartment in Manhattan. Okay. And like, I'm entering that, but the reality is it's a movie. And where I really live is in the Turnataxi Palace. That's the thing. Now, I know that that sounds insane, okay? But I feel we use objects as triggers. We use them as sets to set us up and to, like, we use clothing or any other things in the object culture. We use them to position ourselves more for ourselves than for others, so that we can be who we think we believe we really are. That's why I like that photograph in the entrance. Along the same vein, I'm going to show you a picture. This, which I never show anybody, is a picture of my sister Jean. She died 6 years ago. This was taken, I'm guessing, around 1964. And my sister Jean decided to become a kabuki dancer. Okay. So you have a Jewish, you know, 19-year-old suburban, Lincolnwood, Illinois, teenager who has seriously decided to become a kabuki dancer.
I love that.
She was the, I would say, preeminent Western kabuki dancer.
That's
it says, and I'm thinking, if she could, first of all, it's not like me projecting, you know, you have to see yourself in that position. Look at her with the wig and the,
she looks incredible.
But I mean, she does, like, and she was good. And where this idea of clean slate, you know, imagine, I think it's very American. Mm-hmm. We begin at the beginning, we have no family baggage. So that's a whole other thing. Let's say, as opposed to the cliche of a British, you're born into a certain situation. You're not born into a certain, you're born into a certain situation in America, but it's negated from day one. You could do anything you want. So I love that. And to me, my sister at 19, seriously pursuing a life as a kabuki dancer is inspiring.
Yeah.
I mean, it's everything. I'll show you something else, another photograph.
Okay.
These pictures.
Oh my gosh.
Are the Moss family pretending that they're in a Chekhov play? Okay, these are us. My family sent us to ballet school, and bought these costumes, and here we are in our backyard in Chicago, before we moved to the suburbs, pretending to have like a sort of soiree where the children are performing for the family, and my sister is dressed for Swan Lake. I'm the prince, and my other sister, my twin sister, is dressed as a rose. And look at how bad we are. But we thought, we decided to go from who we are into cultured, cultivated, because we have a Russian background, Chekhovian, like, family.
But this was something that was encouraged, surely, by your family, otherwise...
By my mother. She felt that everyone should dance. and that we should perform in costume in the backyard.
It's fabulous.
You know, so it was like, but I mean, and look at how bad we were, but it didn't matter. We were like cultured. It's almost aristocratic.
It is. I mean, the first thing it makes me think of in a sense is the Von Trapp family.
Yeah. That's like, but we didn't do this for anybody. We just did it for us.
But the costumes are quite extravagant. That's
yes,
not the kind of thing
they
that
are.
You can pull together.
No, but that's what I'm saying. It was like there were these, you be the prince, you be a rose, and you be in Swan Lake. And look at us. and they did this to show that we were gentrified. This was to grab ourselves, as they say, by the bootstraps and metamorphosize into an aristocratic Russian family. That's what I think. Okay. That's like, you know, and the weird thing is it's kind of can work. Mm-hmm. Like I feel I had a Russian aristocratic background. But I studied dance with Madame Andre on Broadway in the north side of Chicago. Yeah. But it didn't matter because that is really me in the photograph as a child, as a prince mm-hmm. in the backyard, as a sort of folly, sort of performance, again, a la Chekhov for the family.
That was Aisha Spears with Murray Moss, and we'll be returning to Murray's apartment to hear more from him in a few moments. But first, here's a song chosen by Murray. This is Let's Stay Together by Tina Turner.
I'm so in love with you. Whatever you
Stay Together by Tina Turner. Time to head back to New York to hear part two of Murray Moss's favorite things.
I don't like to rest at home. I like to be inspired by things. And what I like to be inspired by is an object or a group of objects which I could like have my glass of wine and stare at and dwell on and chew on and think about, where I'm not a merchant, I'm like just regarding something. It's like, and I could do it for hours, you know, and fall asleep over it. And then I like to dwell on things, and I can't do that at the office, so I like to do that at home. I think that whole universes, without being overly theatrical, can exist in certain objects, certainly much more than we give them time. Oh, these Ouija photographs. I have a little collection of Ouija distortions. What he did was, and this was in the late 50s and in the 60s, was he went from, you know, street photojournalism, I don't know if you know Ouija, Arthur Fallick, visited Hollywood and then started to do these distortions. And what they were to do it was he had to like change the lens and use the spectrum and mess it up and boil it in water and do it. But if you like come over here for a second, this is the Empire State Building, a series of four. But it's very prescient because look at how Frank Gehry, like he imagined the Empire State Building in a non-rational way as a kind of architecture, which is built now. Look at what he imagined. And nothing happens unless somebody imagines it first. And I think somewhere along the line, somebody saw this and went, that's beautiful. Because look at how beautiful those buildings are.
They're incredible. And it's nuts actually that those are photographs, because it does still look, it's come from something real, but it looks like it's so imagined. It's a strange, like, analytic, synthetic argument between the two, in a way.
That's exactly, because it's a real building imagined, if you could, in a different way, which is goes back to everything that I'm talking about. It's just the fact that we have powers of altering, and that there is no reality. I mean, yes, there are hardcore realities, but we have imaginations, and we can use objects and situations to make new realities, like my sister did with her kabuki dancing, or my parents attempted to have us do with our Chekhovian dance moments.
Oh, this is Kathy McClure. It's
what Kathy does, she's an artist in Seattle, Washington. What she does is, what this is it's a, she took a vintage and or contemporary stuffed toys. So they would be furry and playful. She eviscerated them. She, like in a taxidermy situation, she skinned them so that there was the core underneath, which was never intended to be seen, the skeleton. And they're mechanical, meaning that they have movement and they have an audio part to it. And they have plastic bits. And they were all, this was all made in plastic, never to be seen. Okay. But she then did a sort of, not Duchampian thing, but she re-rendered this toy through the, let's say, classical sanctioned art-making process of recasting the plastic bits in bronze. So, as if to say, so now I redid it, now is it art? But she reattached the mechanical plastic bits, as you could see. And the first thing that I noticed was how beautiful the sculpture is, mm-hmm. truly beautiful, for something that was a structure not intended to be seen, and how adult it is compared to how cute it probably used to be. And secondly, how when it's now rendered in bronze, so it's matured, it's increased in value, it's gotten older, let's say, how, because the movement was geared to it being clad in fur, without the fur, the object becomes almost geriatric. And when you turn it on...
Oh my God!
That was Aisha Spears with Murray Moss in his New York apartment, hearing about the things that have inspired him throughout his life. Time for a short break, but stay tuned. We're heading north to Vancouver next.
Every month, the Monocle Shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Canadian designer Brent Comer has carved a niche for himself in the world of wood art. His love affair with the material began almost by accident when he was combing through the demolished shipyard buildings in Vancouver, looking for wood to renovate his home. We sent our reporter, Lucy Hislop, to his North Vancouver studio to hear his story.
We've just headed over the six-lane Ironworkers Memorial Bridge, high above an inlet of the Pacific Ocean from Vancouver to North Vancouver. Elongated freight trains to the left, tankers and docks to the right, and home in the middle to the 5,000-square-foot studio of artist Brent Comer. Above us, however, is his playground, the Coast Mountains, a carpet of firs, maples, cedars, and pines. Today, amid the noise of planers, sanders, humidifiers, and axes, whole chunks are being fashioned into curved benches and sculptural tables resembling a drum and a cup. The fourth-generation North Vancouverite explains how this Flintstone chic evolved from an early career in landscaping.
My furniture art career really started in the garden. Clients were requesting benches and furniture. And one older lady said, Brent, you know, this garden is great, but I can't sit on rocks anymore. I need some benches. And so I decided to go out and carve my own. I really wanted wood that was grown from the same soil that my garden was. So I went to an older area in Vancouver that was being regentrified, and I was taking old timbers that they couldn't use anymore and carving very simple forms. And I was discovering, to my delight, that I could now reinstall a more modern aesthetic into a very let's say, natural wild setting. So I love the paradox of modern and ancient materials.
Armed with a chainsaw, he set about teaching himself to work with wood, the perfect medium to communicate his understanding of this rugged province.
We really, as humans, mostly in urban settings, really aspire to getting back to what's real and having a chance or an opportunity to slow down and engage with something authentically beautiful that Mother Nature can provide us. So I felt I had a real opportunity to convey my love of Vancouver and British Columbia. It's the sweet, soft, salty air. It's the scale that really still impresses me.
The 49-year-old's push for BC is working. Over two decades, his pieces have been exported to homes, hotels, and restaurants worldwide, from Dubai and London to New York and Shanghai. Kudos to an artist who works exclusively with the lumber industry's rejects. A man interested in perfection? Not so much.
Well, the wood that I'm really interested in collecting is wood that tells the best stories. And I found, by and large, it's the unprocessed big lumps and chunks and blocks of wood that industry can't utilize in the normal course of their production. It has too many knots. It has a bark seam. It might be split. It might have too much pitch. It might not even be the right length. So I find these are really diamonds in the rough. And it allows me to really delve into the material and get past that surface layer and the volume. Some of this material is 2,000-3,000 pounds that I work with. And the stories that the knots, for instance, talk about and tell, people really love those kind of perceived imperfections in the work because it's the tree's own personality. And it would be pretty boring if everybody was perfect A-grade veneer plywood in this world.
Today, an abandoned 40-foot cedar rescued from the side of a hill is being rolled into the studio, one of myriad salvages from all over the province. Where we see nothing but gnarly firewood, he'll bring together a bunch of spindly trees so that their centres are all beautifully exposed as a flat surface. Then he'll round it, cube it, even turn it into what he calls a kiss, cutting the piece through its midsection to look like two sets of lips.
So there's one tree that we do cut down ourselves, and that's alder. Alder is primarily a wheat species here on the coast. Alder here is the mother species of the forest for the large conifers, such as the Doug firs and the cedars. Its job in nature is to go in where the land has been cleared or cut down, seed itself quickly. It has a short lifespan, but during its life, it's the only tree west of the Rockies that fixes nitrogen in the soil. But then when its lifespan or its time is up, it'll decompose very quickly and provide nutrients in the soil for the larger conifers to come in. So we collect alder along roadsides, primarily from Vancouver to Whistler. So I had this idea of flying over top of blankets of green hillsides and mountains in British Columbia, looking down. And I was this huge giant, and I thrust this cookie cutter down and I plucked out a cube. And so that's why when you look at an alder cube, the sides are carved. Well, still, I couldn't see down into the forest, so then I cut all the treetops off. So that gave me my cube form.
He's worked on wood eaten away by the pine beetle, a bug that's infested parts of the coastal region, and even his collection of cedar bits and bobs gathering sawdust in the corner of his studio has transformed into a table of shattered pieces. It's all part of a process where Brent works by instinct rather than by plan.
I tend to create and think about work on an emotional level, which as a business person has its nuances, let's say, because I really should be doing a bunch of benches in another collection, but I'm really drawn to bigger, deeper stories. I love working with the material that I have at hand. I love taking it to other countries. I'm hoping that they'll find it interesting enough that they'll actually come and visit British Columbia and just see why I'm so excited about the work that I'm doing.
In North Vancouver, for Monocle, this is Lucy Hislop.
Our understanding of modern design in the 20th century was largely formed in Denmark. Today, the plucky little Nordic country is still a world leader in the field of design, though it's less about furniture building and more about incorporating design into society as a whole. The Danish Design Centre is a government-funded institution designed to promote, connect and enhance this strategy. And it has a new CEO, Nille Juul Sorensen. I spoke to Nilla to hear about his new appointment and what he hopes to do in the role. You took over as director in November 2011. What do you hope to bring to the role? I mean, you were an associate director at ARUP previously, and you had an architectural practice before that in Copenhagen, and were responsible for building the metro. From your previous experience, what do you bring to the role of director of the Danish Design Centre?
I think I'm bringing in design. Let's get the designers back. I think if you look back in history, the previous directors didn't come from a design industry. So what I would probably bring in is enthusiasm and the intuition of designers. So this building where we are placed in Copenhagen, just opposite Tivoli, in a fantastic address, has, you know, been very exclusive. So you were either invited or you were a tourist. Over the last couple of years, we haven't really connected to the designers. And that's my biggest aim, to get design back into this building and to get, you know, a bit of rock and roll in the building, that do exhibitions, which is, you know, challenging.
Of course. And I mean, part of the problem with Danish design is that it has this huge, very sort of globally recognised heritage that's very much rooted in sort of furniture and design in the sort of traditional understanding of what it means. Do you feel that sort of the Danes, as the new generation, haven't really stepped up to the board in terms of being progressive in the way that they feel about how design can improve all aspects of life?
I think, you know, looking back in hindsight, you could say they didn't step up, but there was a reason for that. They never got the chance, because I think, you know, some of the big producers here of furniture or kitchenware, they had designs from the 50s that is still selling fantastically. So they didn't want to let the young designers in. So the young designers here have had a tough life. You know, they have to go to London, Berlin, Holland to get the designs going. But what I can see now is the next talent pool is fantastic. And I would like to give a home to them. So this is, you know, they can start here and get their designs out to the producers, get it out to the public, because the channels for that have been, you know, limited, because we had all this very good design from the 50s, but we also need, we need designs for a new future. And I can see that the young designers now are changing into a more sustainable design. The whole sustainable agenda is very high. So I think it's a promising time, that the talent pool is there. There's a step change going towards an ecological age. And I think the Danish designers will start buying into that. And you see it slowly, that the young designers are using material in a different way. And then you also have the ones who's diverted into what I call more welfare design, where they start helping the government and the institution in running the country in a more design thinking way.
And my final question is how sort of fragmented really the Danish design industry is, in terms of there's obviously the Danish Design Centre, but there's also Danish Crafts, there's the Danish Architecture Centre, and they're all sort of funded by different ministries within the government. I wonder if you feel that maybe they could be sort of coordinated to work together to present a more united front that might sort of help things operate a little bit better.
Yes, and that was one of the first things I said when I arrived here, was that we have to cooperate. I come from a consultants world where you cooperate with architects, with designers, you know, everybody trying to solve a problem. And unfortunately, for a lot of years in the Danish design world, we had all these institutions fighting each other, and we're basically fighting the same money, we're fighting the same customers. I have had meetings and a fantastic positive response, that we start looking at how can we cooperate, how can we actually make exhibitions and fairs that promote Denmark, where it's not just promoting, you know, product design or architecture, but it's the total. Because what is really interesting about Denmark is that we have all these nice design things, we have all these very good architects, but it's the society, it's how all this is baked into a society, and functionally, even though that we pay way over 50% in tax, we're still happy people. So that's what I would like to say, is the Danish Design Society. For a small country with 5 million people, it is hard to operate in a global world, so we have to be more agile and better to, you know, to promote our products.
That was the new CEO of the Danish Design Centre, Nilla Juul Sorensen, talking to me earlier. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. Stay with us, we're off to Ljubljana next.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D. Now, prefab architecture promises so much, but rarely ever delivers. One small firm in Slovenia, Rico, is bucking the trend, though, building beautiful, sustainable wooden prefab homes. Philippe Stark is a fan, but don't let that put you off. We sent Amy Gutman to Ljubljana for a tour of a wooden Rico home.
It's a very simple house. Small and simple, just for two people.
Retired oil executive Boyan Koppel and his wife are on their second Rico home, made entirely of wood.
Show me some of the design features of Rico here.
It has to take a very simple way. It's very easy to see. There's an entry, living room, little kitchen, which is separated of the living room. I like this much more than to be in, but it's functional done. And then the small utility done here with everything to prepare for the laundry. It's one small toilet place with a small sauna, and you see. And I like this. It's a nice feeling to live in. It's warm enough. You don't need a lot of heating. We use only the fireplace to heat all the house.
Those are some of the benefits of a Rico house. Each customer designs their own home based on a model. Wood walls, floors, ceilings, and solar energy conducted through photovoltaic roof panels all create an eco-friendly and affordable house to live in. Excess electricity can even be sold back to local providers. Yanis Osman is hooked based on his heating bills alone.
If I build again, I will take Rico house again.
Why?
Because it's made from wood. It's always warm, it's always...
So it saves you money?
Yes. 1,000 euro approximately on year for gas, that's all.
How does that compare with a non-wooden home?
The other will spend 2,000 euro.
Boyan Koppel agrees, despite the fact that Rico homes started about 300,000 euros, and that's without the land. And prefab isn't necessarily a dirty word. Some of the homes can be built in as little as 2 months, keeping emissions down in both the production and assembly stages. The only downside? The same fire that warms a Rico home can also bring it down, quickly. Beyond that, Rico seems to have a cult following from its homeowners. To find out about Rico's growth markets, project manager Tom Bogatai takes me on a driving tour of Ljubljana's suburbs.
The last 5 years, Italy is our biggest market. They have become modern in Italy because they have a long tradition of building in brick. So this was something new, and it's a huge market, and it's close to us. So the transportation costs of a house are not very high.
Stylish Italians aren't the only ones to have discovered the timeless quality of Rico. French designer Philippe Stark has partnered with the firm and just created a prototype, combining his signature transparent glass walls with Rico's wood ones, creating a classic natural aesthetic. Architect Rok Klanchek explains the distinction of a Rico Stark home.
Do you think that traditional house is four angles and just normal roof? Then of course we are changing the foundation of the understanding of the traditional home, but he's thinking about changing the way of living, not just the transparent walls and so on, but also the measures and also the connections between functions in the house.
The Rico homes, to begin with, almost like a modern or abstract painting, for their simplicity, how are the Stark homes different to the regular Rico homes?
Wooden houses from Rico are very solid, more wood is present in the houses. Stark houses
again, more transparent, less material, more open spaces.
One of Rico's biggest selling points is their willingness to work with clients on even the most exacting requests. Tom gave me one recent example.
A lot of the clients come to us because our competition won't do what they wish. So if a client comes to us and he wants, I don't know, chicken feathers on his facade, we can do it. We'll say yes and we'll do it. We'll figure out a way.
What's been the most unusual request?
The houses are made out of wood and you can see the inside walls, and wood of course has knots in it, and we had clients that didn't want any knots. They wanted a clean wooden finish, which meant we had to go through a lot of wood to make him the walls that he wanted.
How many trees?
There's about 30 trees in an average Rico house, so here I think at least 100. Of course we use the 70 for something else. One more thing, he wanted the wood to be from the trees that they had to cut down where the house is standing right now, which is good. It's very sustainable, ecological, so we thought it was a good idea.
And architect Rock Klanschek shares his own story about clients' quirks.
The solutions are sometimes unusual. Recently I have a request. She had to have a glass wall between the garage and living room because the customer has one old, very nice car, and he actually wanted to look at his car from the living room. So maybe this one is also the strange one.
But that's small stuff compared to Rock's biggest and most important client.
Work with Mr. Stark is very specific work, according all the wishes, all the special architectural features and wishes and expectation, of course. It's specific and not easy. The Stark house for me is a kind of final architect dream to eliminate the border between exterior and the interior.
It may not be easy, but if Rock can please Mr. Stark, together they could both transform residential design into environmental masterpieces. In Ljubljana, for Monocle, I'm Amy Gutman.
Next up, it's time for a trolley dash around the world. The dark days of the Northern Hemisphere in January had us looking for a bit of light in our lives. So this week, we've dropped in on lighting shops in London, Helsinki and Beirut to hear what's selling.
My name is Ulla Stormoy. I'm the director of Atrium, and we are the distributor for Floss in the UK and have been since the beginning of 2011. And we're here at the Floss showroom on Rosebery Avenue. It has a very wide collection of products, and generally there's a family of products which embodies the collection. The Global, as an example, which is the bestseller, is its simplicity. Very, very simple, beautiful piece, crisp, can fit within many different types of interiors. Move on to something like Sky Garden. Very crisp from the outside and very detailed on the inside. There, Marcel Vonders wanted to replicate the cornice detail ceiling in his own apartment and introduced that detailing to the inside of the fixture. So there's a contradiction between something like Global, which is very simple, and Sky Garden, which is much more complex in its design. But with Sky Garden, you have some element of mystery. Until you're underneath it, you don't see the detail. Where it becomes interesting is the developments that are coming through, and specifically with LED. Within the lighting sector, we're seeing LED being used a lot within commercial type applications, as yet not so much in residential type applications. And what we saw last year with Floss was an introduction at the Milan Furniture Fair of a largely decorative-based product range, all featuring LED light sources. This will introduce a sort of an element of energy saving, which everybody's striving for these days. And the products are being designed with a realistic price point, which is absolutely essential. So in the shop window at the moment here, we have Smithfield, originally launched here at the Floss showroom on Rosebery Avenue because of its proximity to the Smithfield market. Then next to that we have Can-Can by Marcel Vonders, both in the larger size and the mini size. Both Smithfield and Can-Can are suspended fixtures. And then we have the Marcel Vonders chandelier at the far end, which is the Zeppelin, and that's the large one, which takes up a vast amount of space.
My name is Mie. I'm an interior architect and industrial designer. And right now we're in Scanno in Helsinki. Scanno is a family-based company that's been around for 65 years. We started out by making bookshelves, and now we are one of the leading brands in Finland for importing design furniture, and then we also have our own collection. We have a very wide selection of lights. We have everything from very standard ones like or standard brands like Luciplan, Foscarini, Floss. But then we also take in a lot of smaller designers. In the shop window right now we have Tobias Grau, Thomas Kral. We have Sensis, especially their lamps Eyes, which are very, very, very nice. They are basically formed of a cube, and you turn it on by, they have like four sensors on each side. So you turn it on by actually putting your hand in front of them. So you can choose yourself how many sides you want to have on. So it's a very, very nice design. What's selling now is actually mostly wall lights. Those have become very, very popular again. Like one model that is selling very well is Louis 5D by Ligne Rosette. So it has this kind of like very ornamental design to it. It's very simple. It's just an acrylic sheet. You can choose between the colors, and then there's basically just like a bulb attached to the wall. And you can get it in different sizes, and you can actually change the sheet as you want.
My name is Bénédicte Fleuriot. I'm the Director of Brand Development at PS Lab. We're based in Beirut. Our headquarters is based in Beirut, in Lebanon. But we also have offices in Stuttgart in Germany. We are now in our guest area that we have actually developed a few months ago to again be able to offer a great experience to our clients. I think it really portrays the company and the brand and our identity when you look at the color of the walls and the texture that we are using, from wood to steel to black colors, and that's really a space to talk about the project and to feel comfortable and gaining trust from each other, from the client perspective to our perspective. PS Lab work all aspects of lighting products, from concept to construction. Every piece that we develop is made out of a specific environment. We custom manufacture all our products in our own factory, which is also based in Lebanon, a bit outside of Beirut. All our products are finished by hand with minute attention to details. But all those products were developed according to a specific space. What we do is also a bit out of the norm, in the sense that we create our concept and then we manufacture our products. Usually you have a lighting designer or you have a manufacturer, but you don't always have the combination of both. We are different in the sense that we are not a typical supplier. We're not a supplier at all. We are not a shop where you would come and buy a lighting product, but we're not a lighting designer company, and we're not only manufacturers. So it's really a combination of creation and manufacturing, which come out from detailed craftsmanship, which is also very, which is really our core strength as well, because we offer a different quality of product. So, for example, we lately finished the Iris Cocktail Lounge and Restaurant in Beirut, which is an open space, a rooftop. So it was very interesting, actually, to work on a rooftop, because there is no ceiling, no walls, nothing, and we had to really give life and fill the space with lighting and life. We are looking at opening an office in London. France is an important market as well for us. We are looking at opening an office in Italy. So it's really to be able to grow and have sort of satellites, which would really cater to clients and offer them the best service that we can offer them. Still knowing that the creative head is still taking place in Beirut.
That was PS Lab in Beirut. week's Section D. But fear not, we'll be back again next week, hearing how one LA rapper got hooked on design, how the D&AD Awards look at 50, and we'll also be hearing the word on the street from the latest menswear shows in Milan and Paris. This week's show was produced by Gillian DeBias. Our researchers were Taya Erdl and Hazel Pfeiffer, and our editor was Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening.